Welcome to the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review, where we cover all things national security, military, foreign policy, and history. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Sean Rosker. Today, we're launching a new episode format, one which we're very excited about, in which we'll be presenting a narrated version of a peer-reviewed journal article from Nick Lekas, a senior columnist at the Georgetown Security Studies Review and fellow SSP colleague. We'll briefly introduce you to Nick up top and let him explain his motivation for writing the piece before diving into the article itself. We hope this new format finds resonance with you and serves as a way to better connect our audience with the terrific work being carried out by our colleagues at the Review. Above all, we hope it's informative and contributes to the broader foreign policy debate. Enjoy. Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for appearing and for volunteering yourself to be the first test subject of this new episode format. I'm excited to dive into this.
Yeah, just love to be a guinea pig where I can.
I'm excited to talk to you today, even if only briefly, because I'm hoping you'll be able to give us some context to frame the issue your article tackles and to help people better understand the broader dynamics at play. But before we dive into it, why don't you just really briefly introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Nick Lekas. I'm a second year student in the SSP program. I've had a background in Russia for a lot of my educational career and my professional career, and been always fascinated by the country. You know, my dad used to speak the language, so I'd always see these strange looking letters, and I'd ask him, what are you looking at? And so he'd sit me down and walk me through things, and next thing you know, here I am working on a whole bunch of stuff with different articles at GSSR, along with various stages of my career as a contractor, where I've been leaning in and helping out with my regional and linguistic knowledge where I can.
So you bring quite a somewhat extensive professional background to this issue.
I'd like to hope so. But I mean, as we've seen over the past couple of years, whenever you think that you've more or less got a solid understanding of Russia, something gets thrown into the mix, and I have absolutely no answers for what's going on. So it's a dynamic subject.
It certainly is. And I'm hoping that, just by broaching this topic today, while not likely coming out on the other side with any issues, hoping to better inform and understand what's going on at play here. So tell us, what's your article about? Why do you want to write about it? And why is it something that people should be familiar with?
Sure. So the essence of my piece was talking about the deep imbalance that we've seen in terms of the makeup of Russia's military forces, especially those fighting in Ukraine, whereby percentage-wise, the vast majority of Russian soldiers are from their ethnic minority regions. And they have sustained shocking levels of casualties, which one thing I do want to stress is a lot of times when the media it talks about however many casualties they estimate to have. Most of the time, they're just talking about soldiers who've been killed in action. But this goes beyond that, right? You're talking about soldiers who are wounded to the extent that they can't fight, or they're sick, or captured, or otherwise labeled as missing. So we're talking about a very high number of soldiers here who are just incapable of fighting for the Russian military. And we've seen that there have been serious repercussions of that, because a lot of these soldiers are being taken from regions that are not doing very well economically, and most of the time rely on industry and factory work to sort of sustain a sort of economic upkeep, right? And a lot of this workforce has been either conscripted or otherwise mobilized to go fight in Ukraine. So bearing that in mind, I tried to dive a little bit deeper into why this is taking place and how that could lead to potential cracks in the wider system that Putin's created here, because the fact that the Russians have so heavily tapped into their populations in these ethnic minority regions is both a political and security measure, which we can dive into a little bit more.
Yeah, real briefly, let's just dive into that. You mentioned the crack in the broader system. What might a fissure within that minority group look like?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, a lot of the usual suspects are, you know, if you look at Russia's history, are the Chechens, Dagestan, Buryatia, these places like that, where they have these very fiercely independent and proud cultures, which has usually led them to butting heads with whatever system of power is in Russia at the moment. And even though right now it looks as though they're relatively under control, you know, it's not going to take a lot for these regions to flare up every now and then. I mean, you know, the perfect example in these last couple of days was this, basically the pogrom that we saw in Dagestan, where a flight was purportedly coming in from Tel Aviv, and a mob descended on the airport searching for, you know, Jewish passengers. And the response was a little bit concerning, to say the least, because the Russian National Guard sort of let this happen for many hours before slowly starting to get things into order, and then of course immediately blaming things on the Ukrainians or the Americans or whoever would be the appropriate boogeyman at the time. But just because things ostensibly seem to be under control and there's no open revolt right now does not mean that the groundworks for further instability are not already there.
So, is there any other important context that listeners or those who want to read up on this issue more should keep in mind when listening?
Sure. I think there's a couple of things here. Firstly, understanding that a lot of these decisions when it comes to which populations get conscripted and mobilized or not comes down to where the political value or lack thereof lies. So if you look at a lot of the numbers from open source research, proportionately, there are less soldiers who have been mobilized from areas like St. Petersburg and Moscow. And not surprisingly, these are very politically valuable areas for Putin, right? These are also very heavily Slav areas, or at least associated with that. And to suddenly start pulling men off the streets and sending them to the front lines in Ukraine could start to cause a lot more political problems for Putin than he may want to. First wave of mobilization was extremely unpopular, and that was without starting to really get folks from those areas, those more affluent and educated areas, pulled into the war. So being able to go to areas that the Kremlin views as more, quote unquote, expendable is going to, in their minds, create less problems for them. So understanding that, I think, is going to be very beneficial for folks.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for allowing PGP to present your work and for taking the time to introduce it to our listeners.
Thank you very much.
With that, let's dive into the article. Mobilized, forgotten, ignored. Russia's control mechanisms of its minority populations amid the Russo-Ukrainian War by Nick Lekas. The recruitment ad for the Russian military, released in the spring of 2023, hammered home the sentiment that signing up for service was not only patriotic, but manly. Considering the issues affecting Russia's military recruitment and conscription efforts as its casualty count in Ukraine increases, the ad fails to demonstrate another key reality in Russian society today. Most of the men fighting in southern and eastern Ukraine are not Slavic, as portrayed in much of Russia's recruitment media, but rather from its minority populations. According to a 2010 census, Russia is home to over 193 ethnic groups and host to a broad variety of religious beliefs, cultures, and languages. Centuries of tight control have seen indigenous and ethnic populations stringently controlled, reflecting a deep-rooted fear in the Kremlin of ethnic uprisings that would uproot Russia's security ecosystem and threaten Putin's rule over the country. With the onset of the Russo-Ukrainian War in February 2022, this control has been no more visible than on the battlefield, where casualty rates disproportionately affect Russia's minority populations. Though there are some exceptions, notably in Chechnya, the Kremlin's military and security policies work towards the same goal, broadly appeasing politically valuable Slavic populations at the expense of its many ethnic and racial groups. According to Russia's Federal Statistics Service, Buryatia and Dagestan are the Russian federal subjects with the lowest GDP per capita. An ongoing open-source project between Mediazona and BBC's Russian service has corroborated at least 33,904 Russian casualties as of October 6, 2023, with some of the highest death counts per region coming from Buryat, Kuban, and Dagestan. Ethnic Buryats, for example, similarly suffered among the highest number of losses during fighting in the Donbas in 2014. Decades of persecution have resulted in these groups having little to no political power and lacking any autonomy. Poor economic prospects, living conditions, and high levels of corruption within the government mean that a career in Russia's military, bolstered by higher wages, is one of the few escape routes for men living in regions like Buryatia and Dagestan. As such, Russia is disproportionately mobilizing minority soldiers who are killed in the trenches of the Donbas, Zaporizhia, and Kherson regions of Ukraine at far higher rates than Slavic soldiers. Notably, many of these deaths occur in Russian infantry units placed on the front lines with a higher risk of death. This social economic stratification has a long-term tradition in the Russian armed forces because young men from the cities with relatively good education serve in other military branches, but the infantry consists of badly educated soldiers from poor families and regions. Further, Alexandra Garmayapova, president of the Free Buryatia Foundation, has blamed the region's widespread lack of opportunity at home on this mass conscription of the region's population. As a result, this has led to misleading accusations of involvement in Russian war crimes. Media reports investigating the March 2022 massacres in Bukha indicated that the Buryat-based 64th Motorized Rifle Brigade was based in the town at the time of the atrocities. The Buryats are ethnically Mongolian, and since Russian and Ukrainian school books detail how the 13th century Mongol hordes ransacked Moscow and Kiev, they make easy scapegoats. So much so that Buryat is now a shorthand for all Asian-looking soldiers. Reports have similarly emerged of racism within Russia's forces, with Russian army officers bullying Buryat, Kalmyk, and Tuvan soldiers, and infighting between Chechen and Buryat forces, resulting in gun battle in Russian-controlled Ukrainian territory. All these stories, isolated and unrelated as they may seem, are part of a broader strategy by Russia to play these groups against one another. Putin thrives on fomenting a security environment of both mutual benefit for its elite and deeply rooted mistrust and animosity between peers. If populations with a history of revolution and uprisings are too occupied with infighting or jockeying for position in Putin's court, this significantly reduces the likelihood of a challenge to the president's power. Nowhere is this more evident than in Chechnya. Unlike other regions across Russia, Chechnya has been largely preserved from disproportionate mobilization and combat use in Ukraine. In the early weeks of the fighting, Chechen forces were deployed outside the suburbs of Kiev, where they sustained heavy casualties in Hostomel and failed to send squads to infiltrate the city with the goal of assassinating Volodymyr Zelensky. After that, they saw sustained action in the siege of Mariupol in April, which saw them sustain high casualties. Since then, reports of substantial Chechen involvement on the front lines have diminished drastically, and its population has largely been spared of mobilization and conscription efforts. This is largely due to Putin's need to maintain the region's leader, Ramzan Kadyrov, in a politically advantageous role. The same applies to Kadyrov. He receives an abundance of funds from the federal budget, he wields a private, extremely loyal army, and he has the authority to persecute the Chechen opposition to his rule as he sees fit. Chechnya was the site of two brutal wars in the 1990s, which saw Russia put the region under its direct control in early 2000, under the leadership of Kadyrov's father, Akhmat. Kadyrov today is one of the prime examples of a member of Russia's elite who profits off Putin's mutually beneficial style of rule and needs the government to remain stable just as much as the government needs Chechnya to remain stable. The primary way in which the Kremlin seeks to achieve this is to let Kadyrov operate with quasi-autonomy in Chechnya. Mobilizing Chechens to fight and die in Ukraine at the rate seen in Buryat or Kuban would likely become far more of a political quagmire than Putin would want. Thus, beyond a few battalions still deployed well behind the front lines in Ukraine, Putin lets Chechnya be. For now. For the moment, Russia's disproportionate deployment and mobilization of its minority populations to carry out the war in Ukraine has not met significant resistance. Some sporadic protests in local town centers or videos of aggrieved family members have accomplished nothing, and there is no indication that this policy will change. For Russia's Ministry of Defense to begin large-scale mobilization of its Slavic populations, particularly in population centers like Moscow and St. Petersburg, would mean that the state of the conflict would be in truly dire circumstances. To do so would be a significantly unpopular decision, more so than the initial round of mobilization in 2022. It would threaten a long-standing yet fragile system that encourages high-level political corruption at the expense of those whom the Kremlin views as unimportant or even disposable. Though Putin's power may seem absolute and unchallenged, the unprecedented number of casualties and lives forever changed in Russia's ethnic populations may become a larger problem for his rule than he may realize. As a reminder, the views expressed on this podcast are the views of the participants alone and do not represent the views or opinions of Georgetown University, the Precision Guided Podcast, or any other agency. Thank you for listening to the Precision Guided Podcast. Follow the Georgetown Security Studies Review on social media to stay up to date on the latest Precision Guided Podcast episodes and GSSR content. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn, or you can visit our website at georgetownsecuritystudiesreview.org. Thank you to all of our listeners out there. This is the Precision Guided Podcast, the official podcast of the Georgetown Security Studies Review.